Good morning.
Good morning.
I don't know if this is going to work like this, but if it doesn't, then my words won't be recorded, which is just fine by me. I actually thought there'd be far fewer people here today because of the brisk weather we had last night. So it's good to see you all. I'm going to speak, I've been reading several books recently about, from a Quaker perspective, about spheres of spiritual practice and formation and development. It's a series of three books, two of which have been written. And the title of the series is Spiritual Listening. And it's intrigued me to for a number of reasons. The woman's name is Patricia Loring, and she talks about or writes about spiritual listening as a pattern of practice, spiritual practice and formation, that occurs in personal practice and practice in the community, and in the Quaker world, the community is the meeting house, or that group of people who have gathered together to practice. And then what she calls ethical practice, or practice in the real world, or in the world, in the community, out there. And so I've been intrigued by it as a way of thinking about how and where we all practice spiritually and are formed spiritually. And I've also been intrigued in some of the differences between a Quaker perspective and a Zen Buddhist perspective. She talks about these three spheres, the first one being personal. And a key element in personal practice is, for her, is retirement. Is stepping away on a daily basis from everything else, and settling in personally, settling in alone, to create that space. And for her, that practice involves prayer and a lot of different things. And I was thinking about it in terms of a Zen perspective. And we also, I think, in our practice have retirement, stepping away from the world, the busy world, the dusty world, on an everyday basis, we make time for meditation. Dogen says, for practicing Zen, a quiet room is suitable. Eat and drink moderately. Suspend all involvement. How's that go? Anybody remember? For practicing Zen, a quiet room is suitable. Eat and drink moderately. Suspend all activities and all involved in something like that. So we do that on a regular basis. We also practice Zen personal practice besides Zazen or meditation. It includes walking meditation, mindfulness practice, which is when washing the dishes or sweeping the floor or simply paying attention, bare attention with no conceptualization. We have more exotic practices that aren't necessarily Zen, but a lot of people practice what's called a Tonglin practice, which is a breathing practice, and it can go both ways, but breathing in the pain and suffering of the world, or visualizing or imagining that, and breathing out peace and harmony. Personal practices also are reading and writing, journaling. But time away from the world to practice spiritually and also form spiritually. And then she talks about she calls it corporate practice, and that's a Quaker term. It doesn't mean corporation, but it means the corporeal body, the body of the meeting coming together. We, in Zen, we call it Sangha. But the communal, the spiritual communities practice together, supporting one another in our practice. And we do that a lot of ways in Zen. We have sesshins and retreats where we come together and have a fairly tight container to help us all practice silent meditation together. We practice together sitting daily. We practice a liturgy and services and chanting. Another type of practice is tending the building, tending the grounds, keeping the place clean and neat, making sure that there's no dust on the altars, there's no dishes in the sink. We also come together for classes, and we come together to support one another when we're going through hard times, marking celebrations and transitions. And that's the Sangha practicing, and each of us developing spiritually and practicing spiritually together. And then the third sphere she identifies is, she calls it ethical. She hasn't written this book yet. I think she's having a hard time with it. The book is I called up my friend Bob Schmidt. No, I emailed him yesterday. I emailed him and said, Bob Schmidt is a fellow who teaches Chinese painting in Minneapolis. And he actually taught a course here, a class here once on Chinese painting. And he did the design work for this book. And I didn't realize that until after I'd purchased these books, that Bob Schmidt had actually done the design for the books. So I emailed him yesterday and said, well, is Patricia Long ever going to write that third book? The last one was published in 1999. Where's that third one? And he said, well, she just in the last few months contacted him about doing the design for it. So he thought another 3 to 5 years that book would be. So practice outside. Spiritual formation and spiritual practice outside in the world. She calls it ethical, the ethical realm. And this is practice at work. Practice with your family. Practice with your neighbor. Practice as a consumer. Practice as a citizen. The point being that there is no place you are not practicing. There is no place that you are not spiritually forming. It doesn't happen here on a Sunday morning. It doesn't happen just when you're sitting zazen. It happens when you're sitting on the toilet. Yikes, yeah. And she makes the point that this is not consecutive. It's not you got to master personal practice before you can move on to community practice, before you can move on to ethical. There's nothing consecutive about it. It's all happening at once. And you can't wait to deal with something at work or enter politics until you're perfectly formed personally. It just doesn't work here. Now, interestingly, she describes patterns that are in each of these spheres. And the main pattern is spiritually listening. And I found that really intriguing because in her worldview, does anybody know what she's spiritually listening to or for? Inner voice. Yes. Yep. Yep. And God. Yep. Yep. They also talk about God. I mean, opening to listen to God speaking through, or as the inner voice. But there is a lot of that waiting on, opening up to be, to. to be open to God, to be open to the divine. As it comes through you individually. Now that poses a problem for Zen folks, because we don't posit a God. We don't posit a divine to speak through us. So I began to think about, well, what are the patterns of our practice that go through personal spiritual formation in spiritual formation and practice personally in the Sangha and in the outer world. And I came up with several, and I'll speak about one. Does somebody have a watch? I keep on forgetting to wear my watch at the Zen Center. Thank you. So I think there are patterns. It would be interesting to ferret out and understand as they unfold in these three spheres. The one I'd like to talk about is a pattern of thusness, which is a classical Buddhist term. One of the 10 names of the Buddha is Tathagata, which is translated as thus come, thus gone. Thus perfected one. It refers to the awakened Buddha. It refers to the Buddha as manifested as a human being, as an actual human being. In Zen, we call that a sack of bones or a sack of flesh to kind of make it real. It's the Buddha. Is described as taking each step and leaving no trace. I mean, just in the present. It's one of the descriptors of the Buddha. It's also a descriptor of you and me, and a descriptor of all reality. We don't exist anywhere other than right in the present moment. Dogen says, seeing forms, we immediately clarify the mind. Hearing sounds, we immediately realize the way. Clarifying the mind. What an image. You see things settling out. See a jar of water. Just the mind getting clearer and clearer. Seeing forms, we immediately clarify the mind. It represents enlightenment or being awake. It represents seeing one's own nature. As the mind clarifies, as the mind settles, as the mind stills, your own nature becomes clearer and clearer. The dynamic flow that is you or me becomes clearer and clearer. You see and experience the flow of the present moment, of the time being. Seeing forms, we immediately clarify the mind. Hearing sounds, we immediately realize the way. Think about getting stuck in a traffic jam on the way to a meeting and you're late. And the anxiety that can sometimes produce. And then imagine just seeing forms, just hearing sounds, coming back to actually what's going on in that car and letting all of the anxiety and angst and verbal torture to just settle down and be where you are. My guess is that if you're able to do that and just say, oh, this is what it's like to be late for a meeting again, that something shifts. And your experience of the present moment is significantly different. Just seeing, just hearing, no conceptualization. Thusness occurs as both a subject and a pattern in a lot of the Zen literature. And again, Dogen will oftentimes write, in his writings, but also in his collected works, which were talks that he gave, he'll go through these long, long expositions of some complex Buddhist topic or existential topic using allusions and concepts dating back thousands of years. And then he'll simply end with a question like, and this happens again and again, do you completely understand the principle I am discussing? And you can, I mean, I can just imagine all of the monks kind of like, wow, you know, it's like, man, right. And then he'll pause and he'll say, the five-petaled flower opens in the timeless spring. The single circle of the moon is white in the dawn sky. Again and again and again, he will write or talk about these incredibly subtle and complex topics, and he'll end up with a phrase. That brings us back to a flower and to the moon. Come on in and grab a seat. Give you one other example. There's a story where he goes through probably 4 or 5 minutes of an interaction with one of his students debating a classical Zen take on the Buddha, a Theravadan take on the Buddha. And then he says, heaven is not high. The earth is not dense. Mountains and rivers and the sun and moon are not separated. The radiant light of each place penetrates each place. A Persian riding on a white elephant enters the Buddha hall. Two Handan people with bare feet circumambulate the monk's hall. What principle can we rely on to be like this? After a pause, Dogen said, the bright moon follows someone as if there were a reason. Naturally, white clouds provide rain with no mind. The bright moon follows someone as if there were a reason. Naturally, white clouds provide rain with no mind. Again and again and again, all of these complex perspectives end with being right here, right now. Thousands of words, myriad interpretations are just to remove obstruction. Obstruction from experiencing the present moment. What's happening right now? A couple of weekends ago, I was snowshoeing on the Upper Tamarack River. I have a little shack up there. It's what used to be called a three-season place. No insulation. If we had running water, we would have to shut it off before we left. It was a cold weekend. Not quite as cold as this. I don't think it got above 10, though. And it had just snowed. This is probably around the turn of the year, right around the first of the year. And the woods were blanketed with snow. We snowshoed in because the driveway's not plowed, about a quarter of a mile. Because it had just snowed, there were some mouse tracks and squirrel tracks and deer tracks, but not too many. So I was just snowshoeing. My partner and I kind of, he got on the skis and he went out for an aerobic. Well, actually, mine was aerobic too. But he kind of likes to move faster than I do. So I'm just plodding through the woods. Crossed the frozen river in a place where there wasn't a current. Kind of late afternoon. And I stopped and let my breath settle. And all of a sudden, I realized that the entire woods, the air, as far as I could see, was full of billions and billions of water crystals just hanging. Just hanging. Kind of like, you know, dust motes in a room. They had been there all the time. But I had to stop and pay attention. And then I could see in the fading afternoon light. It was just kind of, it was one of those experiences like, oh my God, what's going on that I'm not, you know, that I'm not observing, I'm not aware of. But it, being in the present, thus is being in the present moment, in personal practice, in community practice. Here's another Zen story. One day, Bai Chang accompanied Matsu on a walk. A flock of wild geese flew past them. This is a pretty common Zen story, commonly recited. Matsu said, "What's that?" Bai Chang said, "Wild ducks." Matsu said, "Where'd they go?" Bai Chang said, "They flew away." Matsu then twisted Bai Chang's nose so hard that he cried out. Matsu said, "So, you say they've flown away?" Upon hearing these words, Bai Chang obtained enlightenment. So when Bai Chang, from his dualistic point of view, says that the ducks have flown away, old man Matsu tweaks him back into reality, tweaks him back into the present moment, tweaks him back into time being. Where'd they go? Who knows? What's happening now? Where'd the last moment go? Who knows? It's not here now. What would have been a more appropriate response in a situation like this? A friend of mine died last fall. And he's a dear friend of many years. His partner of 30 years would often refer to him as the manifestation of isness, which really kind of fit John. I gave Mark shortly after John died. I gave him a death present. I don't know what you'd call it. I gave him a book of Basho's poetry, Basho's haiku, translated with a commentary by Robert Aitken, because just to celebrate John's life with a book of poetry and writing about isness, about being present, about blessing. But John was kind of an amazing sack of skin and bones in my mind. And I was present the moment he died. And he was up in his bedroom. It's Mark and John and I. And they had moved the bedroom from the front of the house, kind of the big bedroom. It was an old 1880s house over in the west side of St. Paul. And they moved the bedroom as John got sicker and sicker to the back of the house. And part of the reason they did that is because there were windows on two sides. And although you couldn't see the Mississippi, you could kind of look out, and there's the gorge, and there's downtown St. Paul. But it was surrounded by oak trees. So it's kind of like, and it was faced so that the sun came in the morning and would also come in the evening, and it's kind of like being up in a treehouse. And so about a year ago, they moved the bed back there. And John had been pretty much out of it for about 24 hours, breathing softly, not moving, clearly towards the end. And about 3 or 4 minutes before he died, he began to breathe more laboriously. And Mark became somewhat anxious and went to his side and called out his name pleadingly. And then it was over. John took his last breath. And through all that, just seeing, just hearing, one hand on Mark's back, one hand on John's heart, feeling my own heart pounding, just present, just present. Mitsu Suzuki written haiku, and she wrote a number of them when her husband, for a couple of years when her husband died. And in the tradition, the funeral was quite a ways after Suzuki's death. And she wrote a haiku, Autumn Valley. Funeral eve chanting arises, drifts away. And another, eating a persimmon. I remember the one who loved this taste. So much of Zen is just about being present. Just about being here. Adding nothing. Adding nothing. So back to Loring's three spheres or realms of spiritual practice and spiritual development. Personal, corporate, as she calls it, and in the world. It's pretty clear about how we practice thusness, or how we try to practice thusness, or how we form thusness when we're sitting on a cushion in our personal practice, being present. It's also, I think, that pattern. You can see it in our corporate practice, in our communal practice, in our sangha practice. How we, although it's not a Zen thing to do, but how we aim at being present, just totally present. I mean, there's stories about, or a story I heard about, I think it was Katagiri, how somebody met him and he was greeted by him. And the sense was meeting someone where there was no personal agenda. He was just present with you. Didn't have his concepts. Wasn't sizing you up. Wasn't trying to figure out what you wanted. Wasn't trying to... But was just present. Just totally present. But around here, how we try to be cognizant of bringing that peace and equanimity into our relationships, into how we work around here, in being still and aware and present and open. And open. It gets a little harder when you think about that practice or that development out there, you know, when your kid's doing drugs or in the heat of a political campaign. Or in that traffic jam. Or when you're dealing with a hostile worker. I'm dealing with a hostile court right now. But I think there's a couple things to keep in mind. This isn't consecutive work. It isn't getting it right on the cushion before you're out there in the real world. It's not consecutive. It's happening all the time. And that spiritual practice, spiritual formation, is not different from everyday breathing, eating, pissing, defecating, driving a car, shopping. That is where spiritual practice and formation takes place, as much as when you're on a cushion. So as I read these books, I kind of became curious and interested in how, if you think about those three realms or spheres, and you think about spiritual practice and formation happening all the time, how do we do it? What are the patterns that we practice and engage in? And I'm not done with it. I mean, I'm curious, and I want to think about it and read that third book if she ever writes it. And I think it's just really quite important in this world in which we live today, where there's so much going on outside. How do we bring our practice? How do we bring our we often talk in Zen about, in Buddhism, there's the Bodhisattva vow, freeing all beings. It's freeing all beings from suffering. It goes back to the Four Noble Truths, that there is suffering. Suffering exists. There's a cause of suffering, which is grasping or clinging. And there is the cessation of suffering, which is the cessation of grasping or clinging. And when we talk about saving or freeing all sentient beings, or we talk about spreading the Dharma, it's not going out with Zen stories. It's not going out with Buddha scripture. It's bringing that sense of stillness into the world. That sense of having or clarifying the mind doesn't have to be crystal clear. There can still be some sediment. But stilling the mind and clarifying it and bringing it out into the world, into your interactions on a day-to-day basis, and as you think about taking action in a political campaign, voting, or figuring out what to do with global warming, really almost doesn't matter what it is you do. What matters is spreading the Dharma or freeing all sentient beings by entering the world with a sense of peace and calm and equanimity. And again, the jar doesn't have to be crystal clear. There can be still some cloudiness. That's it. I'd be curious, particularly with these, in terms of the practice and pattern of thusness and the three spheres, I'd be curious or open to hearing what people have to say or your reactions or your questions.
Talked about the difference between listening for God or listening for something else. That's a place where it just that feels like there's some cloudiness still. Mm-hmm. I was raised in the Methodist Church, but practice without really an explanation for well, what is it if it isn't God? Like I learned, that's just open. And I guess I'm wondering if you could speak a little bit to that. That's just what we have then, just the open space there in the Buddhist tradition.
Oh, I see. No, we have solid reality. There's nothing. There's no open space. It's pretty solid. Yeah. I mean, that's how I think of it. I mean, there's just color. I mean, just seeing, just hearing, and those are senses. So there, and those are senses. But just smelling. Just tasting. In Buddhism, there's the sixth sense, which is consciousness. And when we talk about clarifying the mind, it's just observing the mental formations. So to me, there's no open space. It's all manifesting right now.
Do you have a question
there? Yeah, but do you want
the idea then from where is it doesn't matter?
Yeah, I don't think in Zen or in Buddhism there is no there. There's only here.
You know, we have the amazing capacity to conceptualize.
We do.
Human beings, and it's always amazing to me after I started to practice for a while. Obviously, we all say, well, geez, I must be crazy, I'm so far removed from anything else, but how easy it is to see with your thoughts and to hear with your thoughts and to not actually see with your eyes. And it became kind of a practice in and of itself to just notice that I was hearing conversations with somebody that wasn't there. I was seeing images all the time of things that weren't in front of me. Mm-hmm. And had that battle to return.
Mm-hmm. It's
an interesting battle.
Yeah.
So when you said no open space, are you meaning like no separation?
The Quakers have a long tradition of 100 years back of activity in the world, of going out and doing things against slavery and war. That's a very kind of concrete being out there.
Yeah.
How does that compare with what you were talking about, just bringing that stillness into the world?
Well, that's kind of a great curiosity for me. It's kind of one of the places where I spend a lot of time. I just got back from Washington, D.C., where I was trolling the halls of Congress, talking to people lobbying, basically. When I was here. And I think, and talking passionately about politics, Buddhism has a rap and a tradition of being pretty much focused inward, compared to the Quakers or compared to the Catholics. And I think what I'm coming to, and again, I'm really, this is an area that I'm quite interested in, is there's an element of there's nothing in Buddhism that says stop, don't think. It says you can't make decisions. You can't decide something's right, a war is right or wrong, or some action or political actions right or wrong. And then what do you do with that? And there's a couple things I think. And that's that. I really am waiting for her to write her third book. That's where it lands. I think there's a couple things for me. One is that from a spiritual point of view, from a Buddhist and Zen point of view, it's a matter of doing whatever the action is. If you decide to, fight against slavery or for civil rights or human rights, that you do it with a spirit of calm and stillness. It can still be direct. It can still be, you can still be clear and you can take a stance. But do it in a way that does two things. One is with a stillness and calmness and a not being attached to the outcome. Because you know what? You and I, and as much as Al Gore would say we can change a lot of light bulbs and we can really make a difference, and I think we can, we don't control it. And our, I'm involved. I mean, I'm getting into politics, but I also realize it's not the end game. Politics, I think, is important. It does make a difference what Congress does. But there's deeper stuff in being so letting go of an attachment to what the outcome will be. And I think that's an area where Buddhism has some things to learn from Quakers and from Catholic workers' movement. And, we had Teigen Lighten come here to do a workshop probably about a year ago. And he does a fascinating job about somehow making Buddhist principles line up exactly with American tradition of democracy, and it's kind of amazing what he does with it. So it's a long ram. I don't know. I mean, it's an area that I'm very, very interested in, because, and I've said this before, I think Buddhism has a moral obligation to enter the fray, because I think Buddhism doesn't have the answers. But it certainly has something the world needs right now. It has something that we're almost morally obligated to bring into the fray, to bring into the discussion. At a social group. I firmly believe. But I'm biased. I have my little worldview that I work out of. That's what we all do.
I was speaking to a group of women the it was all women. The other day, and they said, so what does Buddhism do with social action? And then somebody else was answering the question for me a little bit when they were talking about the Eightfold Path, and one of the tenets is right action. And so it's there. You know, it seems like so much goes with what the culture is from where Buddhism is, and in this culture, right action. Mm-hmm. Getting in. The monks who were protesting. They were right there. That was what was important to do.
Mm-hmm. And I think it's important to remember, or know, if you don't already know, that in many ways Buddhism was a response to the collapse of the Indian society. Now, actually, it wasn't the collapse of the Indian society at the time. It was the radical transformation. When the Buddha taught, India was going through radical transformation. It was becoming urbanized. The systems that had been in existence for millennia were falling apart. Incredible warfare and clans being conquered and eliminated, and this consolidation going on in urban areas. That's the root spring. I mean, that's the wellspring of Buddhism. And as we face, I think, similar crises on a different scale, that's where I think we have an obligation to move out.
And just letting out what T said, I think about the Van Koan with the 100-foot pole.
Mm-hmm.
Once you're up there, it's really hard to be able to do anything. Last year, I went on this adventure to Panama, and I was sitting on this 100-foot pole on this volcano, and I could see both oceans, and I was so alone and cold and freezing and wet. And now I'm here in Minnesota in the winter, and I'm able to be on the ground 2 feet, and my pole's kind of gone now.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I told myself back then that I'm going to come back to Minnesota and move Midwest, I probably would have thought I'd be disappointed, but it's actually been nice being able to assemble and dissolve into here.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I mean, socially engaged Buddhism is getting very popular in the West Coast. They have many houses in San Francisco called base houses, which are a community of socially engaged people. I think BASE, BASE.org, has actually, they've kind of rewritten the precepts to be socially engaged.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a big movement now.
Yeah. And there's some stuff also going on in New York City in terms of particularly young people, young Buddhist practitioners getting engaged. Yeah, what's going on?
Is there a disconnection from emotion within stillness?
Ah. Emotion. When I talk about consciousness as the sixth sense in Buddhism. There is a non-clinging. So an emotion, like a thought, somebody can correct me, going off that, are mental formations. Now they oftentimes have a physical aspect to them. But there is an element of not clinging to or not grasping. So the emotion arises, as does the thought arise. But I do think that with practice, the emotions perhaps don't get so wide, and that there's a that they do so. They do so. Not that they go away. Not that thoughts go away. Not that you see something and. Or hear something, or experience something, and at a physical and mental level, and the emotion takes away. But there's an awareness of it as simply as a passing, an impermanent passing experience. And I think. Element of not falling into the illusion that emotion is you. It's there. It's real. Anything else?